why Cornel West's tenure fight matters. Earlier this month, Cornel West announced he was leaving Harvard to rejoin Union Theological Seminary after he was denied tenure at Harvard. In this last 40 seconds we have, explain.
Right. Very quickly, I think Dr. West shows enormous integrity by making a decision to leave Harvard to go to Union, go back to Union in many ways. Why do I say that? Because he could have stayed at Harvard. The chances of him being fired are pretty slim, and he understands that. He was making a larger statement about what tenure is supposed to represent. That is the protection of our intellectual and academic freedom. And there's a relationship between the story you told about Bandy Lee, for example, with Cornel West, that if we can't speak out, if we can't do our work and make controversial stands and not be protected, then we don't need tenure.
Robin D.G. Kelly, professor of history at UCLA, studies social movements. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
I'm one of 2.7 million children in the United States that has been impacted by parental incarceration.
I've been in and out of foster care and been all over the place since she hasn't been in my life.
I came to prison broken. Just 2 months after arriving, a judge agreed with DHS's recommendation to terminate my parental rights.
When my crime occurred, I was living in domestic violence. I was forced into prostitution. I was a young girl who was living on the streets. I had battered women syndrome.
Everyone has to do their time, take accountability, but at the same time, let's not punish the child more too.
Join us, 11 a.m., March 31st, to hear from mothers who serve time in prison, discuss bills now before the Oregon legislature to help incarcerated mothers and their children.
Have you gotten your flu shot? It's never too late to protect yourself, your family, and your community against the flu. This year, it is more important than ever. Black and African Americans, people of color, pregnant people, people without health insurance or a regular health care provider, people with pre-existing conditions like asthma, diabetes, and cardiovascular disease, and people 65 and older are encouraged to get a flu shot. Multnomah County Health Department and Portland Community College are hosting a free weekly drive-through flu vaccine and COVID-19 testing clinic that will be held every Wednesday from 11 a.m. to 6 p.m. until March 31st, 2021, at PCC's Cascade Campus, Parking Lot 1, located at 701 North Jessup Street in Portland. Entrance is on North Albina Street. You can drive through, bike through, or walk up to. To reserve an appointment for a flu shot or COVID test, call 503-988-8939. That's 503-988-8939. This campaign is a project of the Racial and Ethnic Approaches to Community Health and the Communicable Disease Services programs. It is made possible with funding from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. More information can be found at kbu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Public Service Announcements.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Extinction Rebellion climate activists in Portland protest on the Morrison Bridge, another Oregon House floor session is canceled because of a COVID-19 case, and the murder trial of former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin continues today with opening statements. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, March 29th, 2021. I'm Althea Billings. Climate activists staged a protest in downtown Portland on Saturday, demanding the city ramp up its efforts to reach net zero carbon emissions and take seriously its acknowledgement of a climate emergency that the city adopted last year. The protest was organized by the group Extinction Rebellion, who set up barricades along an off-ramp from the Morrison Bridge, with some participants chaining themselves to a pink boat that was parked across lanes of traffic. Protesters called for the city to reach its net zero emissions goal by 2025 instead of the previous 2050 goal announced in a climate action plan 6 years ago, and for the city to convene a citizens' assembly on climate and ecological justice. Regarding Portland's aim at reducing carbon by 2050, national community organizer Will Rain said, quote, "I will be 72 by that point. This is something we could be solving tomorrow. 2050 is way too late." The protest stalled traffic due to the closure of the main bridge ramp, with only bicycle traffic able to pass. Current city policies to address climate concerns are targeting a number of areas to reach its goal, including improving building and transportation emissions, managing urban forests, and reducing food waste. Recent data on Portland's current plan reports a 19% decrease in carbon emissions since 1990, despite a significant increase in population, which supporters are saying reflects a per capita reduction that most likely approaches 42%. City officials responding to climate activism say the expectation of achieving carbon neutrality by 2025 is a daunting task based on current climate science metrics. Saturday's protests fell short of the 48-hour lockdown on traffic that was initially intended due to alleged reports of other activist groups using the demonstration to carry out acts of violence. In a statement late Saturday afternoon, Extinction Rebellion spokespeople maintained that they are entirely nonviolent as an organization, and the decision to end the protest prematurely reflected that commitment. The court recessed over the weekend in the murder trial of former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin. Samantha Honglong has more with the Racial Reckoning Project.
Ain't no justice in this town.
Community members marched in downtown Minneapolis over the weekend calling for justice for George Floyd. Protesters pointed out there is a long history of police brutality against black people in Minnesota, including Jamar Clark in 2015 and Philando Castile in 2016. Castile's death was captured on video by his girlfriend who livestreamed the incident. Yet, says St. Paul School Board member Chantel Allen, the officer involved was acquitted.
We watched the trial. We were hopeful when we saw that there was jurors of color. We thought that we could possibly get some justice. And still, there was no justice. Say that ain't right.
That ain't right.
Say that ain't right.
That ain't right.
The difference with George Floyd's death is that the trial of former police officer Derek Chauvin is being live streamed for anyone to view in real time. This is the first time that's ever happened in Minnesota.
We need this system to know that we are watching. It's not just the Twin Cities. It's not just the state of Minnesota. It's not just the United States of America, but the whole entire world is watching this case.
Talia Root, a student at the University of Northwestern in St. Paul, says watching jury selection made her question the judicial process and its fairness.
They're trying to be impartial, and then I am just battling internally with, like, what is impartiality? Are you actually being impartial? Are you just being complacent with the situation? And how do we seek justice while also being impartial?
Derek Chauvin's murder trial resumes Monday morning when attorneys will give their opening statements. For the Racial Reckoning Project, I'm Samantha Honglong.
The murder trial of former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin began today with opening statements and testimony from the 911 dispatcher. Chauvin is accused of killing 46-year-old George Floyd in May of 2020 when he kneeled on his neck for almost 10 minutes while Floyd pleaded for his life. The incident 10 months ago led to widespread protests against police brutality and systemic racism. Members of George Floyd's family, along with their attorney Benjamin Crump and Reverend Al Sharpton, took a knee outside the Minneapolis courthouse for 8 minutes and 46 seconds before entering the building for the beginning of the trial. It was originally reported that 8 minutes and 46 seconds is the length of time Chauvin knelt on Floyd's neck. However, prosecutors said today that the number is actually 9 minutes and 29 seconds. The prosecution is arguing that Chauvin broke departmental rules and showed a disregard for Floyd's life when he pinned him down last year. Chauvin is facing 3 criminal charges, including second-degree murder, third-degree murder, and second-degree manslaughter. The trial is being held in the Hennepin County Courthouse in downtown Minneapolis. Due to COVID-19 precautions, plexiglass barriers have been set up inside the courtroom, and witnesses and attorneys are required to wear masks when not speaking. Local youth activists staged a rally in southeast Portland on Friday afternoon, confronting the recent spike of incidents of crime and attacks against members of the Asian community. The Stop Asian Hate rally began at 4 p.m. at Harrison Park on Southeast 84th Avenue, where activists were joined by Asian American Portlanders to speak out against white supremacy and racially motivated violence. The gathering called out xenophobia and anti-Asian sentiment that has escalated in the last year. Members of the rally also expressed their solidarity with Black and Indigenous Portlanders, with individuals speaking about their personal experiences while calling for an end to systemic racism. Friday's rally followed a similar demonstration held last Tuesday at Southeast Portland's Revolution Hall, where the rally cry chanted "Learn Our Names" in response to victims of recent hate crimes being labeled as foreign or others. Both of last week's rallies followed the mass shootings at Asian-owned spas in Atlanta, Georgia, that left 8 dead earlier this month. Two groups representing Portland's Chinese American community organized similar events across the state, with a downtown Portland rally that brought out two Multnomah County commissioners, including Lori Stegman, the first county commissioner of Asian descent. That event included a candlelight vigil and prayer to remember the Atlanta shooting victims and was streamed online in solidarity with at least 20 other cities in the U.S., including Seattle, that held similar gatherings to denounce the violence and hatred. Recent data shows that the last year has seen roughly 3,800 documented racist incidents nationwide. The Oregon Health Authority reported 217 new cases of COVID-19 on Monday, bringing the total number of confirmed and presumptive cases in the state up to 164,164. Oregon health officials reported no new deaths today, meaning the state's death toll remains at 2,375 people. There are currently 142 people hospitalized statewide with coronavirus, including 36 patients in intensive care units. So far, more than 1.8 million first and second doses of a COVID-19 vaccine have been administered across Oregon. Nationally, the U.S. has reported at least 30.3 million cases of COVID-19 and more than 549,000 deaths. Over the past week, there has been an average of about 63,000 new cases per day, an increase of 15% from the average 2 weeks earlier. So far, 29% of the U.S. population has received at least one dose of a COVID-19 vaccine, with 16% fully vaccinated. A new study from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention released on Monday shows strong evidence that the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines are 90% effective at preventing COVID-19 in real-world conditions. Globally, the coronavirus pandemic has sickened more than 127.3 million people in nearly every country. At least 2.7 million people have died across the world. Monday's floor session for the Oregon House of Representatives was canceled due to a case of COVID-19. Oregon Chief of Staff Lindsey O'Brien and Oregon House Speaker Tina Kotek confirmed the cancellation on Sunday, following reports that an individual who had last been in the building on March 15th and 16th had contracted the virus. People that were in the Capitol at that time are still awaiting test results or may still need to be tested, while close contacts of the infected individual have been notified. The Marion County Public Health Division is advising all symptom-free people who may have been exposed to the virus to quarantine for 10 days, while those experiencing symptoms should be tested for COVID-19 and quarantined for at least 14 days. Kotek also directed the state clerk to begin using computer software to read lengthy bills when the House is in session for the purpose of bill reading to reduce the risk of virus transmission. The House has been scheduled to hold both morning and evening floor sessions in an attempt to address the backlog of bills that Republicans have insisted be read aloud. The next floor session is expected to be this coming Tuesday morning, March 30th, unless notifications of additional COVID-19 infections are reported. Climate change has an uneven impact, with some communities feeling greater health effects than others. Washington state lawmakers are considering a bill that would make concerns of these communities a top priority. Eric Tegedoff has more on the story with the Public News Service.
The impacts from climate change fall disproportionately on some people, but a bill in the Washington state legislature aims to put those folks at the center of the conversation. The HEAL Act would define and include environmental justice in the work of state agencies so that people on the front lines of a changing climate, often communities of color, are included in planning and discussion. Sharmi Ajmera is with Front and Centered, which is leading the effort on the measure.
Trying to embed environmental justice into everything these agencies are already doing so they can just grow that muscle so it becomes sort of second nature that they think about equity and environmental justice and what they're doing.
The HEAL Act also creates and funds an Environmental Justice Council, and with guidance from communities and the Washington Environmental Health Disparities Map, allocates funding toward the most impacted areas. Opponents of the bill say it will restrain economic growth and hurt jobs. The bill has passed the Senate and has been approved in the House Committee on Environment and Energy. Giovanni Severino is with the Latino Community Fund of Washington, which works with communities in the central part of the state. He says people in the region have seen more effects from environmental catastrophes such as wildfires and heat waves as climate change has worsened.
We see our homes burning down. We see our communities burning down. We also see the drought that is brought into communities. And for Latinx communities in Central Washington specifically, well, those are the communities that are hit the hardest.
David Mendoza with the Nature Conservancy in Washington says the goal of the legislation is to ensure state agencies understand what marginalized communities need.
So as agencies then develop policy or enforcement plans or grants, those concerns are really understood and programs are designed with that perspective to address the health disparities communities face.
Mendoza says the HEAL Act is headed to the House Appropriations Committee. For Public News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Coast Range Radio. At 6, it's Labor Radio. At 6:30, it's Prison Pipeline. Then at 7, Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be partly cloudy with a low of 36 degrees. Tomorrow will again be partly cloudy with a high of 56. Today in history, in 1958, the Keeling Curve is discovered. The curve shows an increase of carbon dioxide in Earth's atmosphere. Dr. Charles David Keeling began regularly measuring the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, and the data points form a curve that is steadily increasing. The Keeling curve is considered incontrovertible evidence that the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere is rising. The recognition of this fact was one of the earliest and most important steps in discovering the reality of climate change. The quote of the day is from American civil rights activist, writer, and co-founder of the Black Lives Matter movement, Alicia Garza, who said, quote, "The fight is not just being able to keep breathing. The fight is actually to be able to walk down the street with your head held high and feel like I belong here, or I deserve to be here, or I just have a right to a level of dignity." Members of Congress trace a killer's path, Republicans chastise the Biden administration's border policies, and Democrats prepare for Mitch McConnell's veto. With more on the story, it's Mary Sherman with 2021 Talks.
Welcome to 2021 Talks, where we are following our democracy in historic times.
Today was one of the most powerful days of my life. To be able to come here with the wounds still fresh, still hurting the community, to talk with so many people here, including the families of the victims, and hear directly from them how they're feeling.
New Jersey Congressman Andy Kim and other members of the Asian Pacific American Caucus placed flowers at the Georgia Massacre businesses, where gunmen killed 8 people on March 16th. The group followed the killer's 27-mile route to demonstrate these 6 Asian female victims were targeted. Congressman Mark Takano of California called it a racist attack on the community.
These immigrants, working so hard at these businesses, we're trying to provide a way for the next generation, their young people, to be able to make their way in this country to live the American dream.
The group said the suspect should be charged with a hate crime. The press could soon get a look inside facilities housing unaccompanied migrant children at the border. On Fox News Sunday, White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki said they are committed to allowing access after host Chris Wallace alleged the administration is less transparent than the Trump administration. A group of 18 Republican senators saw conditions inside a Texas migrant facility that's about 1,500% over capacity. John Kennedy of Louisiana blasted Biden for reversing Trump's immigration policies and shared a video on Twitter of migrant families he claimed paid smugglers for entry into the U.S.
It breaks your heart, and all of these people here have been used, and President Biden has allowed them to be used.
On CNN, New York Democratic Congressman Jamal Bowman argued U.S. policies caused decades of political instability that sent waves of migrants north. Victoria Johnson with the American Immigration Council explains Freedom of Information Act requests from 2018 describe the harm caused by family separation.
Examples of children crying in custody, being fearful, acting withdrawn and really traumatized, not knowing what was going to happen to them or when they would be able to see their parents again.
New polling from ABC News shows nearly 60% of Americans disapprove of how Biden is handling the border surge, and more than half say it's a crisis. Of Biden's response to the COVID pandemic, 72% approve. The administration is now reportedly developing a vaccine passport that could be used for travel and in the workforce. The Senate continues its work on its version of the For the People Act, the sweeping voting rights bill passed by the House. Co-sponsor Democrat Jeff Merkley of Oregon expects Republican pushback in what he calls the McConnell veto.
I don't like to call it a filibuster because a filibuster implies somebody's on the floor talking, they're doing it in the full light of day. No, this is just a veto by Mitch McConnell over legislation that is in the service of our Constitution and the rights of Americans all across our land.
Supporters say the bill is crucial for the future of democracy. Opponents also cite preserving democracy as the reason why it should not be passed. For Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Mary Sherman. Thanks for listening.
The Blackfeet Nation declares an emergency due to grass fires, and the Bad River Band remembers an elder lost to COVID-19. With those stories and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Blackfeet Nation in Montana declared a state of emergency Sunday due to grass fires and high wind. Residents in the community of Blackfoot were ordered to evacuate as a precaution. Browning Middle School was opened as an emergency shelter. According to the tribe's incident command, cause was being determined Sunday as crews worked to control the blaze. By 6 p.m., 25,000 acres had burned and one structure was lost. A measure in the Washington legislature would expand the state's innovative model for affordable long-term care. Tribes could opt in, as Eric Tegedoff reports.
The Long-Term Care Trust Act, passed in 2019, created a trust fund for Washingtonians through a payroll premium that collects 58 cents for every $100 earned. It was the first of its kind in the nation. House Bill 1323 would ensure that people with disabilities have access to the program and allow tribal communities in the state to opt in. Vicki Lowe is head of the American Indian Health Commission.
The values that tribes and indigenous people have for taking care of their elders and trying to keep them home as much as they can really align with this type of coverage. So they were very interested in it.
The bill also clarifies how people can opt out, such as if they have an existing long-term care policy. The lifetime cap for benefits is $36,500. The insurance industry has argued against the program, saying it could provide better coverage cheaper. The bill currently is in the Senate Committee on Health and Long-Term Care. I'm Eric Tegedoff.
In Wisconsin, thousands have lost their lives to COVID-19, and Native Americans are dying at the highest rate in the state. The Bad River Band of Lake Superior Chippewa recently lost tribal elder Joe Rose at the age of 85 due to complications from the virus. Danielle Kading reports on the lives he touched.
Joe Rose was the first person to welcome Patty Lowe to the Bad River community when she reconnected with the tribe 45 years ago. Lowe is a Bad River tribal member, but she grew up in Milwaukee.
He became like a second dad to me. Everything I learned about the Ojibwe, I learned from Joe.
Bad River Tribal Chairman Mike Wiggins says Joe was an encyclopedia of knowledge about the history of the Anishinaabe people and their cultural practices. He taught people to live in a way that would benefit those for seven generations to come.
From a community perspective, you know, all of our elders are real sacred because they give us those tangible ties to the past and help us remember where we came from.
Rose passed on his teachings to Bad River youth and through a Native American studies program at a private college in northern Wisconsin. That's where Lacouture tribal member Mick Isham first met Joe more than 30 years ago. He's now executive administrator of the Great Lakes Indian Fish and Wildlife Commission.
That guy saved my life, and I'll never forget it, because I swear I don't know where I'd be without him.
Isham, whose dad is Native and mom is white, remembers struggling with his identity. He says Joe helped him find his way. Lowe says losing someone to the virus is always heartbreaking, but she says it hits tribal communities even harder.
To lose those elders who can speak the language and know all the truths embedded in that language is so devastating.
Bad River tribal member Dylan Jennings says many are still in shock, but he knows Joe would be proud to see community members continuing his legacy.
He's made a huge, huge enough impact to where his memory lives on through our language being revitalized and our cultural way of life and our ceremonies being revitalized and still being carried forward.
So that those teachings will live on for the next seven generations. I'm Danielle Kading.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Composers, scientists, and designers have updated Vivaldi's The Four Seasons for an era of climate change. Dr. Anthony Leisowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Leisowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Three 300 years ago, Vivaldi wrote The Four Seasons. It portrays the natural world from birdsong to summer storms. But the warming climate could radically alter the natural world by 2050. So a new version of The Four Seasons has been altered too.
We really wanted to walk that line between being too ridiculously catastrophic and kind of meaningfully changing this to make it sound what we think it might feel like to live in that time.
Tim Devine is with AKQA. The design agency partnered with composers and scientists to develop an algorithm that translates projected environmental changes into musical changes. It allows them to create localized versions for any place where the piece is performed. In the version played by Australia's Sydney Symphony Orchestra, missing notes reflect declining bird populations, and the summer storm is more intense and prolonged. For listeners, the result is familiar but unsettling, and a warning about how the world could change if nothing is done to reduce global warming. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
Bald eagle populations in the U.S. have quadrupled in the last decade, recovering from an all-time low of just 417 nesting pairs in 1963. Today, there are more than 70,000 nesting pairs in the continental U.S. Lily Bolke has more on the story with the Public News Service.
Bald eagle populations have quadrupled in the last decade after nearing the brink of extinction. A new report from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service finds there are now more than 315,000 bald eagles in the lower 48 states, including more than 70,000 nesting pairs, after years of conservation efforts and protections, plus a ban on the pesticide DDT. John Cantor, with the National Wildlife Federation, says the current numbers have exceeded biologists' expectations after bald eagles reached their all-time low of just over 400 nesting pairs in 1963.
The thought now that there are, you know, many pairs nesting in the state, it's absolutely incredible. I see eagles all the time. That's a recent phenomenon.
Bald eagles received federal protections under the Endangered Species Act from 1973 until 2007. Cantor says eagle conservation efforts in New Hampshire have ranged from protecting habitats to wrapping sheet metal around the base of nest trees so that raccoons or other climbing predators can't get up. To avoid a future decline in eagle populations, Cantor says it's key to keep monitoring them and to be diligent in preventing birds from ingesting harmful chemicals. He says lead weights on fishing lines are prohibited in New Hampshire, but not everywhere.
birds like eagles and other fish eaters, you'll die from ingesting that lead. You know, so there's an easy practice that people can take right there to clean out the tackle box and switch to the, you know, non-toxic alternatives, which are widely available.
But while bald eagle populations are on the upswing, research shows other American bird populations are decreasing. Nearly 3 billion birds have been lost in the last 50 years. Cantor says his group hopes to see legislation such as the Recovering America's Wildlife Act come back this session. It would help protect species before they're on the brink of extinction. For Public News Service, I'm Lily Bolke.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Monday, March 29th, 2021. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Jeffrey Wade, the producer is Yasmin Kobanoglu, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Lily Bolke, Samantha Honglong, Antonia Gonzalez, Mary Sherman, Eric Tegadoff, and Dr. Anthony Leiswitz. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 8, it's Too Much Information with Abe and Tracy. At 9, it's Alternative Radio, featuring lectures and interviews with progressive thinkers. At 11, it's Stage and Studio, host D. May Roberts highlights art, literature, and media. Then at 11, it's Art Focus. Aurora Josephson interviews local painter Hank Pander about his new works depicting the Portland protests of 2020. All of these KBOO programs, including the evening news, are made possible by support from our members. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or use our mobile app and click on Donate. Stay tuned now for Coast Range Radio.
Welcome, everybody. Thank you for tuning in to Coast Range Radio, a radio program of the Coast Range Association. My name is Andrew. You can ask us questions or let us know what you think of the show by sending an email to andrew@coastrange.org. We would love to hear from you. I'm here today with co-host Sam Kropp. How's it going, Sam?
It's going great. Good to be here.
Yeah, things are busy. We're working hard. Lots of things happening in the forest front. And today, really excited, we are here interviewing an incredibly talented and dedicated individual who has spent over 15 years working on behalf of forests and wildlands in Oregon. In 2015, she received her master's degree in environmental science from Portland State University with a focus on streams in forested ecosystems. Her thesis research investigated the effects of forest thinning on stream sediment loading and macroinvertebrate assemblages in the Clackamas River Basin in the Mount Hood National Forest in Oregon. She is currently the co-director of the Blue Mountains Biodiversity Project. Welcome, Paula Hood.
Thank you so much for having me, both of you. I'm really excited to be here.
Great, great, Paula. So really appreciate you taking the time. You know, this is interesting. Coast Range Radio, we focused a lot about on Coast Range forest issues, Willamette Valley, maybe some little bit of Southern Oregon climate and activism stuff, but we have yet to have someone to talk to us about some of the Eastern Oregon forest issues. So, you know, what got you starting in this work in forest protection in Eastern Oregon? And what is the Blue Mountains Biodiversity Project? and the work that you do for them.
Thanks, Andrew. So I'm going to actually start with a little bit more of a personal background. I grew up in and around wild natural spaces. My family on my mom's side is from Ecuador, and my mom grew up in Ecuador. We still have family there, especially on the coast. And then another part of my childhood was spent in southern Louisiana. And so being in these very wild natural spaces was very much a part of my experiences growing up and is part of who I am. And particularly in Ecuador, my mom is from a very, very remote part of the Ecuadorian coast in a province called Manabí. And my grandparents raised cattle and grew coconuts and had a largely self-sufficient farm. And I still have family that lives down there on that land. It's right next to the ocean, backing up to jungle. And then in Louisiana, Louisiana also provided some of that very deep connection to very untamed and wild areas. And so I've spent a lot of time in muddy ditches, ponds, swamps, encountering everything from crawfish to owls to foxes and more. And especially in Louisiana, you have these untamed swamps with all sorts of wildlife, birds, alligators, and snakes. And I was chased more than once by water moccasins as a kid. And so, you know, I got to be part of these places with my family and have these very deep connections to them. And they were also my refuge during some very difficult years for myself and my family. But then in Louisiana, you also have a ton of pollution and degradation, and huge swaths of southern Louisiana is known as Cancer Alley for a reason. There are hundreds, if not thousands, of uncapped or orphaned wells in the waterways. The air pollution is terrible. Accidents in refineries are really common. The Exxon refinery blew up when I was a kid and rattled windows and shook houses for up to 40 miles around. People get sick, and environmental justice is really widespread, with marginalized communities and people of color bearing a shocking and completely unacceptable brunt of the pollution and poverty there. And, you know, sorry, this is a little on the depressing side, but, you know, the swamps are disappearing. And so I grew up bearing witness to these things, to the destruction of these unique and important ecosystems that we should be safeguarding as national treasures. And, you know, seeing that the destruction is often at the expense of local communities. And it's very easy to think of forests and swamps as huge and of wildlands as being these endless places, and that they'll always be out there somewhere. And even if they're harmed, they'll recover and be there for us and for all the creatures that need them. But of course, in reality, ecosystems and wild landscapes are really fragile, and often, unfortunately, not nearly as wild or as whole as most people tend to think. And so when I came out west, I was very deeply drawn to the forests and streams in Oregon and the vast landscapes here and that just amazing beauty, and also the access to public lands, which was new to me when I moved here. And also that, you know, there are relatively functional ecosystems still here. And there's hope that we can retain these wildlands and their ecosystem integrity and the flora and fauna they support. Salmon, wolves, wolverine, martens, cougar, and other perhaps less charismatic but no less important species such as lampreys, caddisflies, mollusks, and all manner of plants and fungi. So I, you know, can't help but want to do everything that I can to ensure that these wild creatures and the forests and streams that they support continue to exist. So after I moved here, I started volunteering with BARC, which is an environmental watchdog group that works to protect Mount Hood National Forest, as you mentioned, Andrew. And out of this volunteer work, or because of this volunteer work, I ended up going to grad school and then and working on my master's. Like you mentioned, while I was in grad school, I was introduced to the work that Blue Mountains Biodiversity Project was doing, and I started volunteering with BMBP and saw the just crucial importance of field work and getting out on the ground doing ground truthing and field surveys and the ecological protection work that BMBP is engaged in. And I also fell in love with the forests in Eastern Oregon and how special they are and how wild, and noted that there's a lot less attention paid to those forests and to the protection of those forests sometimes than other places like west of the Cascades, where there's just simply more people to pay attention to these issues. Blue Mountains Biodiversity Project is a small grassroots nonprofit, and we monitor projects on the Deschutes, Ochoco, Malheur, and Umatilla National Forests, and we challenge ecologically destructive logging projects, livestock grazing, toxic herbicide use, and other projects that harm ecosystem integrity in the region. And field surveying is the backbone of this work, and we field survey all the major timber sales in our work area. To get this accomplished, we absolutely need volunteer help, so if anybody is ever interested in volunteering, please contact us. We have a very small staff. There are 3 people on our staff, and so it's myself, co-director, and then Karen Coulter is the director, and we have recently a staff attorney, Cooper Rogers. And so, and as a small organization, we have to wear lots of different hats. And so we split up things like field surveying timber sales, leading the volunteer crews in the field, writing public comments and objections, and also I do most of the managing for our website and create public outreach materials and work with environmental allies and most of the administrative work.
Wow, thank you for sharing that, Paula. That's such a beautiful story of how you ended up where you are right now, from the place that you grew up. We have something in common. I also grew up running away from water moccasins in the swamps of Florida. So we both ended up out here. So
because of the water moccasins.
Exactly. Terrifying little beast. But I'm really interested in learning and maybe having you share a little bit about what makes the East Side forests so unique. They really are so different than the forests here on the West Side, where Andrew and I are located right now, and they are just incredibly special. So could you share with our listeners what is so special about the East Side forests in Oregon?
One of the things that I think is most unique about Eastern Oregon, and I think surprises a lot of people, is how diverse forest types are on the East Side and how the East Side is actually comprised of a complex mosaic of forest and ecosystem types. So in some places, you can even walk from dry upland meadow to open ponderosa pine forest to mixed conifer forest, and maybe come across some riparian areas and an aspen grove to boot, all in the space of an afternoon while walking not that terribly far. So, you know, it's important also to note that especially in some of the drier and more open landscapes, the moisture forests that you come across that exist on the landscape are providing incredibly important cover and shade and refugia for wildlife. So, you know, if you have sort of a dry open meadow or very open forest, then these areas that are wet and moist with streams and a little bit more water, a little bit more shade, provide really important landscapes for those critters. And then also, I think a lot of people aren't aware of just how very moist some of Eastern Oregon's forests actually are. So we have a lot of mixed conifer forests, some of which can be downright lush and often have Grand and Douglas fir, Engelmann spruce, western white pines, and other conifers, as well as ponderosa and larch. And many of these forests are very naturally moist and productive. And, you know, one thing to note is that topography influences this a lot. So especially in areas that are north or northeast facing slopes, in narrow valleys, riparian areas, deep gulches, these all provide natural shading from the sun and often just give enough shade and enough water retention to support more moist forests. And there's a lot of amazing species out there. And so we have some that specifically, for example, rely more on multi-story mixed conifer forests, include American marten, great gray owls, other species of owls, northern goshawk, lynx, bobcats, black bears, and others.
Nice. Yeah, I'd love to spend some more time up there in these different forests and experience that. It sounds really exciting to go walking through and see all these different diverse ecosystems in such a short amount of time or in such close proximity. So there's a lot of talk in Oregon regarding East Side screens and the 21-inch rule. Could you explain what these are and, you know, why they're so important for protecting forests in Eastern Oregon?
Absolutely. So the East Side screens, including the prohibition on logging large trees that are equal to or greater than 21 inches in diameter and breast height, these screens are vitally important for protecting wildlife, habitat, connectivity, and water quality on the landscape. These large trees are the bones or foundation, so to speak, of old and mature forests. And these large trees and the large snags or standing dead trees and the down logs that they eventually become provide crucial wildlife habitat for birds, other species of wildlife, and also provide really crucial structure for streams. And one idea I found useful is to think of wildlife habitat as, or as wildlife as needing critter condos, so to speak. You know, animals and, you know, particularly like birds, for example, need places to rest, stay warm, to hide from predators, to get away from the elements. And so if you think of, you know, like a standard tree plantation or, you know, an area that's been repeatedly logged, a lot of times those areas, most times, are lacking in, you know, these sorts of features like standing dead trees and standing dead wood. And so you just get sort of these widely spaced, homogeneous, you know, trees that are mostly kind of younger often and don't have a lot of like cavities, and there's not a lot of down wood on the forest floor, and the forest floor tends to be very compacted. So there's just no place for these critters to be that doesn't provide the same wildlife habitat. So anyway, I hope that portion paints a good picture in your mind of, like, you know, where are the nooks and crannies where species can live, and does a forest provide that? And so, you know, the East Side Screens tried to get at ensuring that some of this habitat came back on the landscape and what remained was protected. But to understand the East Side Screens and the 21-inch rule, it's really useful to understand a little bit about the history behind the screens. So the East Side Screens came to be in the mid-90s. On the west side of the Cascades, the fight to protect old growth and the northern spotted owl had resulted in the Northwest Forest Plan being adopted. At the same time, you know, rampant logging had also been going on the east side, including old growth logging, and I would say even ramped up after more protections got implemented on the west side. And all of this old growth logging and rampant logging across the landscape east of the Cascade Crest had resulted in a landscape scale deficit of large trees in the region, and as well as resulted in severely degraded forest ecosystems and streams. So NRDC filed a petition in 1993 asking that the Forest Service stop all logging of mature and old growth forests. And this resulted in a scientific panel being convened to review the situation, and they published a report summarizing their findings and their recommendations. They recommended that the Forest Service halt logging in mature and old growth forests, and logging in building and riparian areas, and certain other activities that were causing some of the severe and widespread harm to old growth forests, roadless areas, and streams. And they also recommended that all old growth forests and all trees larger than 19 inches in diameter and 150 years old be protected. The scientists also emphasized in their recommendations that these interim protections be replaced only if a long-term strategy of ecosystem protection was developed. They're really clear that protecting the remaining late successional old growth forests, aquatic diversity and roadless areas, streamside riparian habitats and soils, these things were the bedrock pieces of their recommendations, and that these elements constitute the basic building blocks for restoring these east side landscapes. And maybe I'm getting ahead of myself here, but one of the things that's brought up a lot, you'll see sort of in the, is, you know, people, the Forest Service is pushing the idea that these were supposed to be interim protections. They were supposed to be very, very temporary, and it's now, you know, decades later. But the piece that they're missing is that, yes, they were supposed to be temporary, but they were only supposed to be replaced if there was this larger ecosystem protection plan. And that is not what has happened. So anyhow, going back a little bit, so these recommendations were made, and out of those recommendations, the East Side Screens were developed. And the East Side Screens amended forest plans for all national forests east of the Cascade Crest in Oregon and Washington. And they ultimately included protections that focused on riparian ecosystem and wildlife components in forests. The strongest of these protections was put in place to protect wildlife, and it prohibited logging of large trees equal to or greater than 21 inches in diameter at breast height. And so this became known as the 21-inch rule, or the 21-inch screens. And so that is currently what is under attack, or has been rolled back. So the industry, of course, always disliked the 21-inch screens prohibition on logging large trees.
Yeah, so let's pick it up there. And thanks so much for that really detailed explanation of A, the value of the 21-inch or of big trees, and B, what this rule, this Eastside screen 21-inch rule was doing. I love also your explanation of critter hotels. That was a perfect visual for what's going on in those standing dead snags. So you alluded to something happening to this rule that has done so much to protect these important trees on the east side. What actually did happen as a result of the Trump administration's one of their last moves before leaving office?
So in a summary nutshell, grand fir trees up to 30 inches in diameter and less than 150 years old have lost protections across the entire area. And to just to further expound on that, so protections for other tree species have also been weakened from what was a strong standard to a suggested and squishy and much less enforceable guideline. And so the Trump decision got rid of the 21-inch rule, basically. And so that rule, again, just to reiterate, had required that all green trees over 20 inches or greater than or equal to 21 inches were protected. And they've replaced this rule with a guideline. And then for the guideline recommends protecting old trees over 150 years old. And whether a tree is old will be determined visually by an as yet to be developed criteria. This is especially problematic for grand fir, but I'll get into that more in a second. If there are no old trees to protect, the guideline recommends protecting large trees. And it changed the definition of large trees to 30 inches and larger diameter for grand fir. And for all other tree species, the definition of large trees remains 21 inches or greater diameter. And so, you know, again, to emphasize, the mechanism here for protection has changed from a standard to a guideline. So even for trees larger than 30 inches, the only protection it has right now is a guideline, regardless, you know, even if it's not a grand fir. And then, you know, just to pick up on my note, grand fir, the Forest Service does not have an accurate and consistent way to age grand fir in the field. So the sort of protecting trees over 150 years old is particularly problematic for this tree that they're specifically targeting for large tree logging and saying that they will protect if it's 150 years old. They don't have a good way to determine that. So, and then I also want to highlight that the entire process from when the Forest Service publicly announced their proposal to when the decision notice was signed took about 5 months. It was on a very rushed timeline, and most timber sales, even relatively small ones, have much longer timelines with more opportunity for public comment. There was really only one opportunity for public comment, and that was on the draft EA. Supposedly the scoping was sort of combined with the draft EA, but then the objection period was also skipped. So the undersecretary, which was a Trump appointee, signed the decision 2 days before Trump left office. And so this was a clearly politically motivated rush to get this decision done.
Thank you, Paul. That was really informative. And we like to make sure here on Coast Range Radio that we offer folks ways to get involved, ways to help these important campaigns and issues. So what's being done right now? What is happening to address this ruling, and how can people get involved and support that?
So the Forest Service needs to withdraw their decision to roll back protections for large trees. Right now, we're trying to put pressure on the Biden administration to withdraw the Trump administration's decision on this and to reinstate the 21-inch screens protections. So we're urging people to contact their senators, and specifically Wyden and Merkley, and urge them to work with the Biden administration on reinstating the 21-inch screens. We have an action alert up on our webpage, so please visit BlueMountainsBiodiversityProject.org for more information. And, you know, just to round out how important it is, there's, you know, I really want to highlight here that the Forest Service has essentially taken what was supposed to be, what was a very important standard, specifically put in place to protect wildlife and instead replaced it with this weak guideline that instead focuses on tree species composition and silviculture. And so, you know, instead of engaging in larger ecosystem planning with a holistic view, the Forest Service is very narrowly focusing on tree species composition as an overarching goal. And this leaves out key issues for ecosystems like water quality and wildlife and other key components and values, and ignores how crucial large trees are for all of those values. Instead, we need to be focusing on larger ecosystem planning that prioritizes protections for large trees, mature and old forests, water quality, unroaded areas, wildlife, and other key ecosystem values. And there's still a very clear and widespread deficit of large trees. Every tree out there is very important right now. Large trees make up only 3% of the landscape in eastern, or 3% of the trees in eastern Oregon, and they need to be protected, not logged. So again, we're urging people to call or email their senators, and you can find out more information, more detail, and more talking points and resources on our website.
Thank you. That is a really inspiring call to action. To conclude our conversation, it's really great to leave things with a sort of vision for the future. So when you close your eyes and imagine what a vision for a just and ecologically resilient future could look like, what do you see? How do you envision Oregon's communities and forests thriving in that future?
So I want to note here, and thank you for the question, Sam, most timber sales on national forests lose money for taxpayers, but they do, of course, generate money for local economies. I'd like to see us use that money that currently goes towards subsidizing resource extraction and instead fund projects that truly restore forests and help communities. And so some of those could include things like removing much of the extremely bloated, unnecessary, and unfunded road networks that exist on national forests, repairing and removing culverts to restore fish passage across the hundreds of miles of fish habitat that is currently blocked by artificial barriers, invasive species detection and removal, making communities safer through home hardening, putting in place much stronger emergency alert and response networks, ensuring support for people, especially low-income and marginalized communities, in preparing and supporting them around climate change-related challenges such as flooding, drought, and wildfire.
There's a lot of attention paid to Western Oregon's forests, Pacific Northwest forests, and how important and valuable they are for addressing climate. But big trees in Eastern Oregon are essential for storing carbon as well. How does that play into your work and the value of these forests?
So there was a study recently led by Dr. David Muldrexler, and that study looked at how big trees make up only 3% of the trees on the landscape, but they store approximately 42% of the carbon in those forests in eastern Oregon and southeastern Washington. And so I just think that that's a really key piece of information to hold in our minds going forward. I also want to point out that, you know, I definitely think that looking at carbon storage is incredibly important, and the Forest Service did, to put it nicely, a terrible job at looking at carbon storage as part of the rollback of the protections for large trees. Another thing that I think about a lot and Blue Mountains Biodiversity Project focuses on in our work is also thinking about how, you know, what wildlife and species and habitats are going to need into the future in the face of climate change. And so that looks like preserving biodiversity and trying to make sure that creatures have adequate, you know, both terrestrial and aquatic connectivity, and that they have large blocks of habitat, and that there are climate refugia on the landscape for them to go to. And so, you know, while carbon storage is very important, it's also important to look at the larger landscape picture and protect the areas that will allow for adaptation to climate change, and then also make sure that you're not exacerbating issues that climate change is going to be creating, such as high stream temperatures and potential fragmentation and loss of habitat.
Well, thank you so much, Paula, for joining us and for bringing all of that incredible information and inspiring call to action. that's about all we have time for today. But again, to our listeners, we've been talking to Paula Hood with Blue Mountains Biodiversity Project about the value, beauty, and ongoing threats and efforts to protect Oregon's East Side forests. Thank you all for joining us for another great conversation with Coast Range Radio. We are a radio show and podcast that holds conversations with inspiring individuals who are dedicated to creating a better world. Coast Range Radio is on all podcasting services, including Apple Podcasts and Spotify, and you can check us out online and subscribe to get the newest episode each month. Thanks to our listeners, and we'll talk with you all next time.
This is KBOO Portland.
KBOO has a number of special t-shirts we've created just for you during our month of special programming. Whether you are a metalhead, a punk rocker, a bluegrass fan, or a feminist,